Welcome to The Dream Show. I'm Jane Teresa Anderson, and this is episode 301. And I've just finished recording the conversation with my guest. My guest also lives in Tasmania. She is someone that I know. We do often have coffees with lovely deep conversations. And I felt that you would really love to learn more about her and her life and how she can help you. She's a poet, a teacher, a therapist and a mystic, and her name is Alana Meredith. She's lived and travelled all over the world and now makes home with her partner and young sons on a farm in Signet, Tasmania, Australia. And her lifelong study of art, spiritual practice, mysticism, embodiment and healing informs and inspires her work. She says, "I find meaning in the natural world. I'm moved by the human heart, and I'm inspired by the mysterious beauty of being here. I believe that our relationships are the most complex yet rewarding experiences of our lives, and that when they feel connected, compassionate, and courageous, so does our life. My life and work are in complete devotion to the relational nature of living." So first up in our conversation today, Alana introduces a dream, and as you know, I always ask our guests to tell me nothing about their dream until we start recording, because I know that you enjoy the experience of listening to and also watching now the dreamer express the dream and me hear it for the first time, and how together we take the steps to unpack that dream and where we go. You'll love where we go. And where we go also leads us back into Alana's life, how she got to be doing the kind of work that she does today, and some examples of the kind of work that she does indeed do today, and how you can join her for some of that. Before we go into our conversation, a quick reminder of my website, which is janeteresa.com, and that's Teresa without an H, where you can find out about my dream resources, my services, my books, consultations, and courses. And at the end of our chat, we share Alana's contact details, and you can find all of these in the show notes. So let's go on. Here's Alana. Welcome to the Dream Show, Alana.
Hello, Jane. It's lovely to be here.
Lovely to be here too. Now, we do know each other and we don't live far apart, but I'm in Hobart and you're in the beautiful Huon Valley in Signet.
Yes.
On your farm.
On my farm, which just became officially ours at the end of last year on the solstice, which was very special.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it's very beautiful down here.
That's enough. Have you been outside this morning before we started recording?
I have. I've been outside. We have a chicken coop in development at the moment, so I've stepped away from that, and I've been to my weights training actually early this morning. So I've been up and moving, and now I'm here with you with a cup of tea and time to chat.
That's really lovely. I've been looking forward to this, and of course into your dream. And as always, I have no idea what dream anyone brings. So over to you to describe your dream, and I'll write it down.
Okay.
I'll take notes.
All right. So my dream actually took place last year when I was on a pilgrimage, in an ancestral pilgrimage in Ireland. And I'm going to read it because I wrote it down directly after having the dream, and it's still so vivid in my mind. So I can't wait to share it with you, because I can't wait to hear what your insights around it are.
Okay, that's lovely.
But the dream is that I was on a, it started with me looking towards a woman who was sort of wild and dark headed and a sort of woman in her crone years. And she was rocking back and forth in a rocking chair under this, it was a concrete slab, and it had four posts with a sort of plastic tarp, the sort of thing that you would take camping with you. And she was rocking back and forth, laughing wildly in this chair. And all around me were the women I love most. So my mother, my sister, some of my friends, sort of being allured, like they were in some kind of trance, towards this woman. And I had a feeling of that I needed to protect them from her. So I was screaming at them for them not to listen and not to follow her sort of intoxicating ways and to protect themselves. And no one could hear me. It was like the women around me were in this trance. And no one could hear me except my beautiful partner, who was just standing. I couldn't see him, but I could hear him. And he was standing stable and sure-footed behind me, just repeating, "Stay steady, stay steady. Stay steady and they will hear you." And the moment I heard his voice, the scene ended. And then I found myself on this really wild beach, similar to the one that I looked out through my bedroom window in Connemara. Had wild waves, and I was right on the edge of the Atlantic, literally staying in a station right on the edge of the Atlantic. And roaring seas, and I was looking out to it, and I felt quite afraid. The sea was dark and unruly and very turbulent. And I could hear my eldest son. I have two sons, and I could hear my eldest son screaming out that we had to return, we had to go back, we had to return to safety. And or that if we couldn't turn back, he was sort of going between two things. We either had to move away from the ocean or we had to get onto safety, which was one of these two, for him, these two large barge-like ships that were sort of rocking and rolling on the seas towards us. And then from my left came the voice of my youngest son, which was, again, really calm and steady. And he said, really clearly, "She can do this. She can calm the sea. It's in her name, Meredith. She is the protector of the sea." And instantly my whole inner feeling and world around the dream changed. I was still in the same scene, but I felt different. And I started to remember who I was, and I started to connect to my lineage through the name Meredith. And I stretched my arms out wide, both of my palms turned up, and I began to walk out into this thrashing sea. So the sea did not calm, but I did, in the remembrance of who I am and I guess what I'm made of. And then I found myself in these wild seas, completely calm. And it sort of tapped me into, I felt really connected to my ancestral gifts, and I connected to this feeling of courage and compassion, which made me feel very steady. And the same kind of steadiness that in the previous scene my partner had been repeating when he was saying, stay steady, and they will hear you. And then the dream ended and I woke, and I remember that morning my eyes were still really wet with tears, so it brought up a lot of emotion and it was quite vivid. And that was the end of the dream.
A fabulous dream. Absolutely fabulous. That feeling on waking up where you know you saw that your eyes were swollen because you'd been crying, how did your emotions proceed over the next few hours? Were you still crying, or was it the calm, sense of calm that you described at the end of the dream, or were there more tears?
Well, because I was on the pilgrimage, we were doing dream work. So before, I should probably say that before I had the dream, we drank this blue lotus tea, which is meant to bring on and elevate your dream experience. So we had gathered the next morning quite early with the intention of sharing our dreams. And I was very emotional still, even when I talked about the dream, but it wasn't a sadness. It was more like a mix of reverence and relief that yeah. I was having as I was explaining the part of the dream that made me most emotional when I was explaining it was when my youngest son said, it's who she is. It's in her name. She's protector of the sea.
Yeah.
Because in Welsh, my heritage is Irish and Welsh, but in Welsh, the Meredith name means protector of the sea.
Did you feel, no, that's not a question I want to ask. I'm interested because the protection came into the dream a few times. You know, first of all, you're screaming all your female relatives and women that you love, and you felt that you needed to protect them. So you were kind of, did you feel at that sense of the dream that you had any power as a protector, or was it more like, I want to protect them, but I can't, this is out of control?
Yes, I felt completely out of control and powerless. Mm-hmm. And desperate. That part of the dream felt desperate, like no one could hear what I was saying, and I was trying to protect these women that I loved, and I felt like they were moving towards something that was alluring and dangerous. But I did feel, I did feel powerless at the beginning of the dream, powerless and desperate, I would say.
So there's a real change between the beginning of the dream feeling powerless and desperate, and at the end of the dream feeling like a protector, feeling the courage, the compassion, the sense of calm. So the tears the following morning, and when you were talking about your dream with the women, would have been the relief of having, you know, worked through that and connected with who you feel that you really are. So I do love that. In the beginning, there's also a lot of wildness in the dream. You know, at the beginning, you've got the old lady, and you described her as a wild crone, or she had wild dark hair. She was wild. And then later on in the dream, that you're on the wild beach. You used the word wild again. It was dark. The beach, you said the seas were dark and unruly and very turbulent. And you could almost perhaps describe that as the old crone's hair as well, because you said it was dark, unruly, turbulent. There's a kind of feeling, there's a connection between those two symbols. Got the wild crone that you're really, to some extent, is alluring to women, but you want to stop women getting to her. Then later you've got the same kind of thing, but this time it's at the beach and it's the waves, and you feel the same sense of, oh, I'm not sure about this. I'm really, what was your feeling standing looking at those waves?
Initially, I was terrified because if I was usually standing on a beach looking at wild weather, I would be in awe, because I love the ocean and I love the sea. Water is one of the elements I'm most drawn to. But in that dream, the fear was there because there was this feeling that the only way I could, that I had to enter the ocean. That's what I was afraid of. And that was the calling coming from my eldest son, that safety was on these barges. So to get to the barges, I had to go through this unruly sea. And so I was afraid.
Yeah. It's really interesting there that you said that water, you in waking life, you really love water, and it's almost like a calling to you. You're very attracted to it. You've got to get in it. Mm. We could use the word alluring. The water in waking life is very alluring to you. And at the start of the dream, the old wild woman was alluring to everybody except you.
Yes.
So, you know, one of many threads through this dream could be the sense of, what am I allured to, or what do I feel alluring? And are there times in my life where I am allured or drawn to something that is really quite wild and turbulent, but there's a part of me wants to protect me from that because I don't feel that I'm really well equipped to get into it, into that emotion or that feeling or that situation.
Yeah, that's very interesting.
Yeah.
I hadn't considered that part of the dream at all, because that probably would be the word that I would use with my relationship with water, is that I find it quite intoxicating and quite alluring.
Yes.
Many other things as well, but in my waking life, but the dream represented something different.
It did, didn't it? And you just used the word intoxicating. In waking life, you find the water intoxicating. And I wrote it down. You said to the women, don't listen to her intoxicating ways.
Yes.
The same. So the whole dream, in a sense, begins on one level with, I feel I'm in a situation at the time of a dream which I'm very attracted to, which really calls very deeply to something in my nature, like water does in my waking life. But I recognise, or I feel that I may sense it as intoxicating and slightly dangerous. And if I'm really going to step into this, am I going to step into it? I don't know. I'm terrified at the start of the dream. I'm terrified about stepping into this wildness. I need protection. Now, in the dream, you're talking to your mum, your sister, all these women you love. You're the only one that is kind of saying, oh, no, don't, you know, protect yourself. But it can be really informative and courageous to look at everyone in a dream as representing something about yourself.
Yes.
So there's a sense that perhaps the female side of yourself, if we're going to talk, because we've got a real distinction between the men in your dream giving one opinion and the women in the dream feeling another opinion. Notice that the men tell you what to do. Stay calm, get in the barge, remember who you are. And the women, it's all the feeling.
Yes.
So there's a sense at the beginning of the dream that you're maybe the female side of you or the heart side of you or the feeling side of you is absolutely terrified about what you may or may not feel that you need to do to enter into these alluring and potentially intoxicating waters. Is this wildness something you want to embrace? I guess the question at the beginning of the dream is, or can I step away and do something else? How do I feel about this?
That's fascinating. For so many reasons, because that draws meaning right outside the dream now into my life, and either side of the dream and the kind of themes that I've been working with, and the theme that really arose on that pilgrimage when that dream took place, it was the first night of the pilgrimage too. It's the moment I arrived in the room. I had the far room that faced the Atlantic, so I could see the sea was in my psyche the whole time. And a very different sea to what I'm used to here. The Atlantic is a whole other wild beast, very beautiful, but quite wild. And the theme that came through on that pilgrimage, and actually the prayer that was conjured on the second day after I'd shared the dream, we did some writing, and the theme that came through for me was how to breathe fire through deep waters, which I repeated again and again for the full 7 days of the pilgrimage everywhere that we went around all of the holy wells. And so there was a theme emerging around courage.
Yes.
And around, but courage in the place that I have been that was familiar, which was the water, but having a new relationship with it now, this element, the deep, dark, wild part of water that perhaps I haven't really experienced yet or allowed myself to experience yet.
Totally, absolutely agree. That's really interesting. And I guess, you know, you say allowed yourself to accept by signing up to go to a pilgrimage on the other side of the planet. Did you have any sense in doing that of I want to move beyond my current boundaries, I want to go deeper into something? Was that the kind of initiating thought behind it?
Yes, it absolutely was. I mean, the place I was drawn to, because that's where my ancestors are from, Ireland, Wales and Scotland. It was my 40th year, and I had this calling that started about 5 or 6 years ago that in my 40th year, I wanted to go away and do a solo pilgrimage, and preferably in Ireland or one of the places that my ancestors came from. And Ireland ended up being the first place. And I went to Wales as a part of this trip. I had 3 weeks by myself, but I definitely felt that 40th crossing wasn't just another year for me, or even just a milestone. It actually felt like a threshold. And I actually feel very new and different on the other side of it than I did before. And what's being asked of me in this next chapter feels like courage, which I've spoken to you about before. I'm very comfortable in the place of, and I've done so much of my spiritual practice has been around compassion and service and surrender and releasing control. And what I didn't see that was readying me for was this new theme of courage. I thought there would be something more supple and more soft, more tender, but it's almost like the watery years of compassion have readied me in some way for the fire element, and that fire element coming through in that prayer of how to breathe fire through deep waters, that I didn't have to abandon the water, but that these elemental themes were coming together of fire, which was representing the courage, and the water, which was the depth and the intuition and the compassion.
Yes.
So, yes, I definitely felt that there was an intuitive calling, and I do live a lot of my life based on intuition, and I trust intuition more than anything. So I knew that I would walk, and I knew that I would do a pilgrimage on my 40th. I had no idea what the themes would be coming up, but I could feel that I needed to become more courageous in ways that I hadn't been. Even leaving my family for 3 weeks, I have young sons, and going away by myself for 3 weeks felt like a big deal.
Yeah.
And it was, but now that I'm on the other side of it and I feel that I've crossed that threshold and I'm in a new chapter of life, I look back on that pilgrimage as an essential part of my growth from a soul level.
I love that sense that, you know, before the pilgrimage, it was like, well, I've reached compassion and, you know, I know what I'm doing and I'm steady with where I'm at. Mm. And when I cross the border into something new, I'll be acquiring more skills like that. Whereas in fact, life is always, yeah, okay, you've done that. Right, we're really going to throw you in now.
Yes.
Especially if you're going to lead other people or other women in something, and you know, let's go deeper. And of course, each time we go deeper, it's because we haven't been that deep before, and we haven't been that deep before because we've been in relative comfort zone. So why haven't we been that deep before? Because there's something we've got to face. So you're like the advance guard going into the extra depth with the fire, with the courage, everything you've got, so you can come back after your 40th birthday and offer those skills to everybody and to people that you work with. So at the beginning of the dream, the woman you described as a crone.
Yeah.
In my mind, a crone is much older than 40. But did you have a feeling of like, and next up it comes Alana the crone?
Oh, no, was I her?
No, well, did you come back thinking that there was a new stage of life that you were entering, which was one day? Would you have put the word crone on it?
Yes, and absolutely, and more since that. I've done a lot of, been a part of a few workshops where we've been looking at what the crone is, and I haven't gone through that yet. I haven't gone through menopause yet either, which is obviously the essential rite of passage that has to ready you for that. And I'm looking forward to all of it, but I think it was also representative of like the woman in the chair was about the kind of crone that I would like to be. And I don't want to be guiding or working with women in who have blind faith in me. That's that alluring thing that I actually find that quite a dangerous thing to be, because I do believe that the wisdom we're seeking is within us.
Yes.
And there are people who can provoke and draw that to the surface, but I feel that that work requires a lot of maturity for the person who's doing that and a lot of accountability and responsibility, mostly for how they conduct themselves. And so the woman in the chair, that crone that I was seeing, felt like not the kind of crone that one, I want to become, or two, the kind of crone that I want to work with. It felt there was still something dangerous. But even within that, I think if an ego isn't checked, we can all become that destructive person in the rocking chair, kind of using people's blind faith.
Yes.
And I don't, that doesn't appeal to me because it doesn't feel truthful and it doesn't feel honest. And yeah, I hope that answers the...
It does answer, and it brings up lots more questions. This was your first night at the retreat, at the pilgrimage. Mm-hmm. Was there any sense at the pilgrimage that you were feeling there's a bit of blind faith going on here, or there's potential blind faith, or there's an alluring here that I'm not comfortable with?
Yes. Yes. And as I said before, my intuition and my instincts, I trust them. And so they're strong, just like they are in all of us. I think if we give something power, it becomes strong. And so I trust my intuition. And I knew from the moment that I arrived on that pilgrimage that the leader that we had in that space was someone for me to be, to work slowly with, and to really question, and take a moment just to sit and watch and become discerning, because I didn't immediately feel safe.
Yeah.
And I often do with a teacher or a guide, and I love being in that seat of reverence. And I love to learn, and I love to look to people who are older than me, particularly women, to learn from. And my instincts and my intuition upon arrival said that that was going to be possible, but not in the way that it has previously, you know, in the old chapter of compassion and love and tenderness, that this was going to require a new part of me to come forth. And so in that way, she actually became one of my greatest teachers, because I had to really muster a strength and a courage within myself and assert boundaries that I have never really, particularly with a teacher.
Yes.
I go in very open. So this was a new dynamic, and it required me to enter those deep waters.
Exactly. That's right. So I love that you have at the beginning of the dream, you know, this is also reflecting how you were feeling on arrival, and reconfirming for you how you wanted to be as a leader, as a guide in later life.
Mm.
And then the dream doing that double, the repeat of the symbolism, there's the old crone. I don't want to be like that. I don't like this alluring. I don't want to be allured. I want to move more slowly into this. Then that stepped up to the raging sea, which is a kind of a repeat of the same symbol.
Yes.
How do I deal with this? Do I get into it? Is it alluring? Is it not? Is it intoxicating? And then coming to that decision with help of other dream characters of how to do that. You know, you said, I felt sitting there on the first night that I would need to walk into this slowly. And in a way, that's what you did with the raging seas. You contemplated, there are many ways to do this. I can get in, I can get on the barges, I can, what did your younger son said? Oh yeah, you can do this, you can calm the sea. Mm. All the possibilities were offered to you about how to handle not only the situation at the pilgrimage, but also how to handle your feelings about what kind of guide you were going to be post 40. And how to handle all of that, and how to make people feel comfortable.
Mm.
I'm just looking at the notes. There's a couple of things I wanted to ask. One is, why do you think she was on a, I mean, I think I know, but I'd like to ask you, she was on a concrete square with four posts and a kind of tarp top. What feeling did that give you?
Well, it's totally disconnected from nature.
Yes.
It's all very man-made and structured and disconnected and cold. There's a coldness in the plastic and the tarp-like roof that she was sitting under, and the metal poles and the but then still appearing on the concrete in this really rickety old could even say it's sort of romantic rocking chair. So it had the image of wisdom, I guess, in some way.
Yes.
But what I could see, because I was standing further back than the group, which was the position that I obviously took in my waking life on pilgrimage, is just to sit. And that's often what happens when I feel unsafe. My instinct isn't to become reactive. I usually become more quiet. And so I did. And maybe I could see the plastic,
yes.
And I could see the concrete, and it just it that implied to me, or was a symbol of disconnection.
Yes, that's beautiful. That's what I got to, and particularly with the four, like the four posts. It's like almost a square or a rectangle. I don't know what, but there were no curves in any of that, apart from the rocking chair. There were curves in the rocking chair.
Yeah.
So, like you say, there's the image of the feminine. The old crone, but when you step back and look at it, wrong setting, not connected to nature.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. And that image, when I first had the dream, and as obviously this is happening, this conversation is happening months and many months after, but it's incredible to me how much meaning you can still draw out of it. And I didn't really realize until recently that the woman in the chair was, I thought that the woman in the chair was somebody else in my life. Then I realized the woman in the chair was the group leader. And then now I'm realizing, I think she actually might then represent the discernment, but also the fear that I think I still hold around when you're in that position of working with other people, that there has to be an integrity.
Yes.
And that when it's not utilized and when you're not accountable and you're not really in the service of the heart, you're serving something within yourself, your own ego, that's what it can become. And so maybe that woman in the chair was actually just a representation of what I could become if I was not to stay in my heart and stay in my integrity.
Yes.
And to remember that I'm a person and a human and perhaps even a soul before I'm even a guide and doing the work that I do. And that those things, that there has to be a marriage and an integrity between my life on the farm and the way I am when I'm, and as a mother and as a partner and as a sister and a daughter, that my humanity has to be there and I have to be checking in on that in order for me to be authentic in the work that I do.
Totally spot on. You're right onto it, Alana. It's you know, if we look at everyone in a dream as an aspect of ourselves, she is both, as you say, the potential future for you if you carried on with your work without the you know, without the relation to nature or to your heart. She's that. And she's also, you know, to put that in context, that what was coming to me, it's the kind of thing like when you have a heartfelt thing to offer, you still have to offer it within the structure of a business, whether that's a website, whether that's the accounting you do on the side, whether whatever it is, there are so many structures that have to be in place.
Yes.
And those structures can be alluring in the sense of, I can see what I'm creating here and I've got a structure and that makes me feel safe and this is how I do it. And, oh, look, you know, if I do it this way or if I have a, I don't know what you do, Alana, but, you know, some people might have, say, what you call it, a funnel, you know, so they get all excited about the funnel. And these are all structures and they're important. They're very important in getting to people, getting across to potential clients. But you can get very, you can get very stuck in those things, as I know from, you know, the IT aspects of my business. You can get quite excited and creative and go down these little things and feel really good for what you're doing, then come back, oh yeah, now what was they doing? Oh yeah, relating to people and helping people with their dreams. Yes. So it can be, you know, she may also represent that, your fear or your recognition of and fear of that as a potential future you, apparently offering the rocking chair, apparently offering the chrome, apparently offering maybe the wild things that people need to face within themselves and their emotions, but not having lost connection with nature. So it was a really appropriate dream to remind you of that. And I love how the three men came into your dream as maybe representing that male aspect of yourself, which in some cases could be that, could be the structure and da-da-da-da. But it's like, no, Alana's male side, Alana's yang, is not concrete structure, funnels, whatever it is. It's stay steady, stay calm. You can do this. Remember who you are. And kind of flipped to that, which was really beautiful.
Yeah, that's really powerful to hear that because it emphasises the masculine steadiness that I have within myself, but also what I have within my family unit and my home, which does keep me incredibly anchored and really connected, I guess, to my humanity, which then it's not a big jump and it's quite easeful to see the humanity and to remember the humanity in the work when we get caught up in the, I don't know, I don't use funnels. I don't really know exactly how they work, but any of the systems that we use, it's just, I think when we're anchored in our own humanity and our own heart, it's almost like an instant recognition to see the heart and the humanity in another.
Yes.
And I had probably somewhere in my subconscious that dream represented the, as you said, the fear that if I was to go to these more powerful, fire-infused, wild places, and I thought that my work had gone to dark places and heavier places, which it does, it tends to a lot. But this is, there's something, there's a maturing happening in my system. And I think that's the 40th crossing that this dream almost readied me for, that, oh, there's a whole nother realm of work. And I'll be humbled by that, I guess, at every turn of age. But, and that's that part to me is exciting. But I think that theme of integrity just felt like that's what you need to keep with you. That's yes. That's what you need to keep alongside the compassion, is that fiery integrity.
Yes.
And to advocate for it and to hold boundaries and to create boundaries, which I think that dream perhaps was the beginning of showing me that my boundaries had been weaker than what I had thought. And not even just with other people, but within myself, that I hadn't allowed myself to cross some boundaries.
Yes.
So, yes, I think the dream is just all about me. All about that. Me. It's easy to go, it's because of this person or because of this thing. But really, ultimately, the dream's a beautiful teacher on where I am holding back and where I need to grow still.
Yeah, and that's the beauty of dream work. It is all about us because, you know, our dream is playing back to us how we perceive the illusions of the world, how we look at the world, the experiences we're having, conscious and unconscious. So it's, yeah. It is all about us. But that said, many people are not ready to take that step. They want to get the outer world version of it, you know. So the outer world version, which would also be accurate for your dream, would be to say, this is how you were coping with the pilgrimage and the leader and your feelings about it and wanting to step back and not wanting to be too drawn in. And, you know, we could go down at that level and all that would be true. Your dream was processing that. But if you go at that deeper level, you get so much more.
Oh, you do. And it makes me feel so deeply that all of it was such a gift. Mm. And it really, like I said before, essential for where I want to go and the kind of human that I want to be and the kind of work that I want to create and the kind of mother that I want to be, the way that I want to take care of this land. All of that was really essential for me to go through. And I'm sure there'll be, and there will continue to be more and more of it, but yeah. I would still choose the same place. I would still choose working with that same person on that pilgrimage, because even though she uncovered things differently in me than what I've had previously, I'm still incredibly grateful for the experience.
Yes.
And I wouldn't be here talking to you about this had I not met her. And so for all of it, it's all a gift.
It is a total gift. And so you beautifully said there, you know, I'll change words because I can't remember the exact words, but basically I've come back and I'm now looking at how I can offer these gifts in all areas of my life. You mentioned the farm, you mentioned work. So let's take a step back and say, when you look back over your life, when do you see the first seeds of this work being planted, or you becoming aware of them sprouting?
Well, probably through my early years, particularly my mother's side of the family, who were mostly Irish and Welsh. That was the lineage. There was always a lot of music in the house and art and poetry and going to the theatre. And so that, I think my entry into the unseen was through art and music and what I could feel but couldn't see necessarily. And so I went into the world of performance and singing and dancing and painting, and that was all of my schooling early years. But I had this one incredible teacher at school who was she was a Catholic nun. I went to an all-girls Catholic school. And it was quite open and progressive for what the structure was. And she was particularly amazing, this teacher. And I wouldn't have said that I wasn't an atheist. I was definitely in search and believed in something and could feel something because of those early influences of art and music and even the way my own parents talked about faith. There was just to stay open. And she took this teacher that we had at school, I think I would have been 15, and she took us to see these Buddhist monks perform at Brisbane Powerhouse, which is where I was living at the time. And I remember exactly where I was sitting in that theatre, because later on, I went on to produce for that footwork for them for a while. But I was sitting right in the center of the theater, about four rows up, and they performed. They came out, and there was four or five of them. And they chanted for 2 hours. And I went somewhere, and I remember thinking, I want to understand what that's about. I need to know what that is. It just entered me on the deepest level, but also in the most mysterious way, because I didn't know what it was. I didn't know who they were or what they were about, but it felt divine and beautiful and really moving. And so I started to practice yoga when I was 17. And then from there went on to do yoga teacher trainings and meditation trainings in India and other places around the world. And I think that was sort of the initial beginning. And I worked in the arts as well. So after school, I went and I worked in the arts. So I sort of had this intersection happening where I was exploring the mysterious and the unseen and the spiritual and the emotional through art. And I loved poetry, but I didn't write poetry at that time. I loved to listen to it, and I loved listening to Irish poets particularly. Mm-hmm. It was almost like, probably looking back now, it's probably a bit of a cellular remembering. I didn't even know that there was a poet really emerging within me. I wrote letters and poetry a little bit at school, but nothing formal, and I wouldn't have identified in that way. But when I became pregnant with my first son, Rumi, who's named after the poet, I just began to write, and I haven't stopped. I haven't stopped. And that was 10 years ago, of 10 years now of really solid writing, and probably identifying first as a poet. And not even so much as what the poet does and that the poet writes poetry, but the poet because of who I in the finest parts of who I am, and the most subtle parts, but also the most honest parts of who I am. The poet is how the lens in which I see the world, that I see the darkness and the light traveling alongside, and the unseen meaning traveling alongside the human experience, and that there's always possibility for something else, and that there's always possibility for deeper meaning. But if we're present, so that, I guess, is why we've come to live on land, because this is where I feel most connected and most present. But that, I guess, that would be how all of this work emerged. It was organic, and it was a process, and at times very confusing, and didn't have a label or a certain way. It still doesn't, but that led me into the work that I now do.
It sounds very much like a calling to the mystical, and a almost like in the dream. I didn't mean to reference dream again. Almost like that, just walk into the unknown, walk into the water. I don't know why I'm doing this, but I'm relating to the symbolic and the art, and I you know, can't always necessarily be consciously aware of what this art is exploring or saying. But I'm in here because I want to just delve into it. With your poetry, do you feel that your words express the sense of mystery? Or when you write your poems, your poetry, does some of the mysterious become clarified and become known to you? Does the process of writing elucidate or clarify what was previously mysterious for you?
To a degree, and I don't know if the poet will ever be fully satisfied if the words can give shape and meaning and depth and colour to the feeling of it. But it's the process of writing that I enjoy the most, and it's what I feel I feel compelled to do. It's almost doesn't feel like a conscious decision in a way. And it often happens, which I've spoken to you about before. It happens to me often when I'm outside, that it's almost like a piece of poetry or a moment of insight will come roaring down the hill towards me, and it's instant. And very often I miss it because I'm in the middle of hanging out washing or putting up a chicken coop or doing something where I'm not able to go and sit and write. But to answer the question, I feel that the satisfaction of being as close as I can be to that mystical element, which through the process of writing poetry, I would now use the word God, which I didn't for a very long time. But to me, God is the most mysterious of all, and yeah. It's the most accepting and inclusive of all. And it's the process, I think, that gives the deepest satisfaction and the deepest meaning. And sometimes I will sit back and reread what I have written, and it will, there will be satisfaction in that. But I don't know if it ever fully encapsulates the feeling or the mystery of just being here as well.
Maybe sometimes poetry, particularly if you share it with other people, has to retain an air of mystery so that the other people read it through their own eyes and their own perception and get persuaded by or offered chinks or little pathways or little rays of light from you, from the poem, and then they take those and go their own little journey. In a sense, the poetry maintaining and offering the mysticism itself.
Absolutely, and I think that's probably why I love the way the Irish poets write, because it's not direct and you can draw your own personal meaning from it. And it feels very generous in that way, that the poetry is speaking to the most intelligent parts of you and that you can draw and make your own meaning from the words that have been presented.
Yes.
And I'm sure, as you say, just then, quite truthfully, I think most people, that's why people are drawn to poetry, because it's written for everyone and you can draw the personal meaning based on where you are in your life. I've been reading the same pieces of poetry for a number of years, and it's only just been in the past few years that I've realized that they have really meant different things to me at different times. And I find that incredible. And I think that language, having grown up, going right back to my early upbringing in the house of even my uncle's voice, he had this big kind of deep Welsh voice. He's now a prosecutor, so he uses his voice quite a lot. And there was a lot of music and singing in the house. And so I feel that there was something about language and a reverence for language, not in an academic sense, even though many of them were academics. There was just a understanding that language does very much shape our world, both from our thought and our feeling to our expression. And then the way that it's interpreted is,
yes,
the language has that connection to meaning. So when I look back at that all the way through my arts practice and my yogic practice and even learning Sanskrit and Gurumukhi with Kundalini, there's the language provokes something different within us.
Yes, that's beautiful.
How
do you use that sense of the language producing different, I'll change the word, producing different responses in people? How do you use that, for example, in your therapy when you're working with people?
I'm mindful of my language, I think, and I actually feel that having had that as an unknown gift, I didn't realize you don't, as a child, the gifts that you're just like we don't realize the traumas that are happening at the same time. The two things are sort of happening simultaneously. But I am mindful of, and this is where I think the intuition has really given me a lot of courage and the ability to read people and to be with them and to try and use language that feels reflective of where they are, not where I would like them to be or think that they should be, but really trying to listen. And listening in itself is a language as well. Really listening to what is being said, the timing in which it's being said, the way in which it's being expressed, and perhaps also what's not being said.
Yes.
And so using language as a way to develop deeper relationship, of course, with me, but mostly for them to find a way to develop a relationship with themselves, because that's what my work is. It's relationship therapy, either with themselves or another person. Most often it's with their partner, but I've had mothers and daughters and friends. And so their ability to come together and express I notice the language between them changes as the work progresses, and it's okay. incredibly beautiful to watch. In the beginning, there feels like either a holding back or an urgency to be heard. And then I watch this beautiful rhythm emerge, and that the language is expressive of the relationship that is emerging and growing and evolving between them. And it is like watching music or listening to music. It's beautiful.
Yeah, that does indeed sound beautiful. And I love that thought too, that the couple or the mother and daughter or the friend, whoever it is that perceive that they have the relationship issue with each other, yes. come and you help them resolve that. But listening yes. between the lines of what you're saying, you help them by building relationship with themselves first. And that gives them the deeper wisdom, the compassion, the empathy to then improve the way that they relate to each other. So you're giving them like the double gift. You're giving them more than they bargained for when they signed up with you.
I hope so, because I feel the same about the people that I work with. It's hard not to love people who are coming with their hearts open and humble enough to say, this is where I need to do work and this is where I need support. I find that quality in people probably the most courageous.
Yeah.
And so it's effortless to have compassion and a sense of reverence. I'm energized by my work, and I only work with a handful of people at a time so that I can really give my attention to them, because I do some other things in my business as well. But that work is enlivening.
Yes.
And feels like a very rhythmic, solid part of my work that I really enjoy, and I feel yeah. the rewards of it.
Yes, it's really, you know, I guess similar to me. It's nice to have different aspects of your work because it gives you variety too.
Yes.
And it means you can give your all to this selection, and then you can step out of that and give your all to something else rather than
yes.
kind of doing the same thing. And I know like me, you do, well, not like me, I know you do face-to-face and you do Zoom. I only do Zoom, but you do.
I only do Zoom.
Oh, do you only do Zoom?
Yes.
Okay.
Unless I'm doing a retreat. So all of the therapy is done like this.
Okay, yeah.
But if I hold an in-person retreat, it's obviously in person with a group of people, but they're quite rare. As my children get older, I'll go back to holding more of those spaces.
Yes.
But it's been amazing, and I'm sure you have found the intimacy that can be grown with people via Zoom. I was very hesitant. I was probably one of the last people to move into this space when everyone was doing it after COVID, both with my meditation classes and my yoga and the group practices that we do around certain emotions like anger or shame or forgiveness or joy or pleasure. I wasn't sure about how I could create that kind of intimacy with people. And it's actually taken, I think, because people are often in their own home.
Yes.
And in their own space. And they don't have to do any travel. There's no rushing to be there, or there's something different and surprising about being in this space that I didn't see being possible before. So
yeah,
it's been delightful.
I agree. Now, pre-Zoom, I was doing Skype a little bit, but before that, a lot of it was phone work. And that was fine because, you know, I was used to doing radio, which is all audio. So I kind of quite developed in listening. But a whole new thing opening up to actually seeing a face and, you know, being able to see what was happening for each other and relate in that way. So, for me, I found it's everything that you said there. It's the person being in their own home is important. They're not in a strange place and looking around to see what you've got. Well, you can look at the background, but you know, they're not feeling uncomfortable. You have to focus your eyes on a screen. You know, for some people I talk to, I can see by the shape, it's just a phone. And some people it's a big desktop or whatever, but you can't really look away and look at other things because this is where the room is. This is where the portal is.
Yeah.
So the focus is quite intense. And for people that maybe use headphones too, you've got the sense of your voice is in there, is right inside them.
Mm.
It's very deep and amazing. But you mentioned there also that, so congratulations for finally doing it after, I'm not being sure. You mentioned they're doing like group sessions. Would you like to talk about that a little bit?
Yes, I think I taught yoga and meditation publicly and online for many years. And I noticed that my yoga classes always, there was always a very strong theme, and I need to work with a strong theme. I wasn't good at just really teaching a general class. I needed to have a theme for every class, and I would have music and poetry and readings and even perhaps questions for the group around a certain theme. And I found it rewarding, and I believe that the participants found it rewarding. So when I moved my work online, one of the things that I really wanted to do was, alongside the therapy, was create containers for people who can come in and gather around a really specific theme. So some of them, one of the first ones I did was anger as an ally, which was hugely attended and just affirmed for me and all women. Women wanting to express their relationship and explore their relationship with anger, and it had, there were so many different ways in which how people felt about the expression of anger. But I've worked with themes around being presence, deep listening. I've worked with the shadow work, so the subconscious and unconscious mind. I've worked with restlessness and what restlessness can teach us and how it can emerge into something very productive and attentive. But I tend to work a lot with, in those practices, we work with the body. So there's a daily practice as a part of that, because I think, and the same with my therapy as well, I do tend to work, we talk and we work with the emotions in the expressed way through expressing what it feels like, but we also go into the body a lot. And I think having had those first experiences with those monks who were sitting there, and what the steadiness in their body, but also the aliveness that came out of them at the same time, really did transport me back to those early years of the body holding the score.
Yes.
And the body being a portal for something, whether it is dance or music. So when I come back into these containers, whether it's in my therapy sessions or the group practices, we have a daily practice, and that also gives people an opportunity to connect with their body and to have a daily practice, but also to start uncovering the wisdom that is in them and that will be expressed and unique and different to everybody and in a different timeline and with a different rhythm, rather than me saying, let's do this thing and then you're going to have a certain outcome.
Yes.
It's more the intention of let's practice. This is the intention for the practice, but let's see what emerges from having done it every day. For usually we do a 21-day sit. And it's incredible within a group how similar, but also how different some of the people's experiences can be. And I see and hear in the group, and many of them comment on this, that they like the practice and they do enjoy being there with me, but I think what they really enjoy is the group.
Yes.
And learning from one another. And I love to be in spaces and facilitate spaces like that, because I do think the group has a lot of wisdom, particularly women when they gather in that way. They share and they support and they evolve and they teach and they advise one another. And it's what I had dreamed of creating. So those containers are really special.
And they're always women. You only accept women.
Not always. If the theme, it has turned out that way.
Yeah.
In my therapy, I have a mix.
Obviously, yeah.
But, and some of the couples, I did an intimacy workshop. So there was lots of couples in that container. But predominantly it has been women coming to the forefront. And that in itself has been informing me perhaps about the way that I work moving forward, but I'll let intuition guide.
God, as always. Well, we've had a little glimpse into your, we've had a little large glimpse into your life. By little, I mean we've looked at some of the things you do and had a large glimpse. And I know there are plenty of other things that we could have explored, but we probably need to bring it around. Now, is there anything else that you wanted to particularly mention or talk about or describe to people listening while you're here?
No, I don't think so. I'm quite enlivened by our whole conversation and feel that, yeah, you and I could speak for many, many hours as we practiced before.
Yes.
But no, I don't have anything more to add.
So people can come and find you and obviously book in to either see you for therapy or into your other containers, as you describe them, which I love, your 21-day containers. Mm. And the best way for them to contact you is?
So they can find me on my website, which is alannameredith.com, alannameredith.com. And from there, there's links to my social media and my Substack, which all have the same name but slight variations, but they're all linked there from my website. And I'll soon be bringing out a very new offering that is being born out of my time in Ireland. It was bubbling before, and then Ireland brought it all to right to a head, and then I've come home and spent the last sort of 8 months creating that, and that will be launched soon, and that will be an offering specifically for women, and one that has probably taken about 10 years of my life to develop, but it's the right time.
I love how you really set up the mystery. I'll tell you everything about it except what it's actually about.
So what it's actually about, we haven't launched it yet, so we have to just be, but yes,
I know.
Mystery is always good. It brings that allure back, doesn't it?
It certainly does. It does. So all those links and the direct links, also you have a Substack, very active Substack. So I've got some notes here. Your links to your website, your Substack, some of your social media will all be in the show notes to this podcast. So thank you for bringing not only your dream for us to all explore with you and enjoy, but also this beautiful little chinks into your life and what you have to offer.
Yes, thank you, Jane. I loved the conversation and I loved the insight on the dream that I knew you were the right person to bring that dream to, and it's really just brought it full circle back into me and I guess what I'm working on and where I can grow and heal and still take accountability, and also what life is calling for within me, and perhaps even what my ancestors were calling for in taking me all the way there and having those experiences. So thank you for helping me bring that dream full circle. It's quite powerful.
Thank you. It's an absolute pleasure.
Thanks, Jane.
I always get to the end of our conversations with our guests and wish we could just go on and on and on, but I do appreciate that a podcast should really probably only be so long. I did hear someone say the other day, I think it was on another podcast, that men tend to do podcasts that are an hour and a half or 2 hours or 2.5 hours long, whereas women are mindful of the people listening and watching and tend to make them an hour long. I don't know whether that's a good judgment or a bad judgment, but I'm mindful of the fact that probably most of you want to wrap within an hour. So we could have talked for ages. I hope you loved what you did hear. And the best step that you can take next is to go to Alanna's website, and her address is alannameredith.com. That's alannameredith, or one word, .com. I've put that in the show notes, and also in the show notes I've put her Instagram address, her Facebook address, and her Substack address. She does do a wonderful Substack. So that's Alanna. Now, have you done any of my courses yet? Because you can start right now with my first course, which is called How to Interpret Your Dreams Step by Step. And you can sign up at my website, and the address for that is janeteresa.com, and that's Teresa without an H. And the link for that is also in the show notes. That's also the website where you can find out how to consult me about your dreams, or to buy my books or do my other courses. Thank you, as always, to Ewan Gray for sound editing, video editing, and composing our theme music. And thank you for listening to yet another episode of The Dream Show. So until next time, have a beautiful day. I'm Jane Teresa Anderson.